Exodus 14:1 through 14:31. The 16th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on December 1, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're going to talk about the crossing of the Red Sea today, getting into Exodus chapter 14. This is one of my favorite passages in Exodus. I've often thought I wish I were an artist. There are a few scenes from the Bible that I would particularly like to be able to paint. And this is one of them. I think this is... This would make a very interesting scene and study in human beings and their reactions to situations. And I'll try to describe what that painting would look like as we go along here. The background to this is that we're in Exodus, we're in the book of Exodus, which describes the departure of the Israelites from Egypt. They had gone down into Egypt during a time of famine, 400 some odd years earlier, and had stayed in Egypt and had in fact become enslaved in Egypt and had multiplied greatly. So there are a lot of them. We won't discuss how many of them there are today. And then God raised up Moses, who led them out of Egypt after God sent a series of plagues on the nation of Egypt and on the Pharaoh in order to compel him to let them go. So they set out, presumably at night, picking up whatever was handy of their possessions, and they took off, and they were led by day by a cloud, and by night there was a pillar of fire that God sent to lead them on their way. And in chapter 13 it says that they left the land of Egypt and they camped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. So that's where we pick up the action in chapter 14. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Pi-hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. You shall camp in front of Baal-zephon, opposite it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, 'They are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in.' Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." And they did so. So in this section, God tells Moses what the battle plan is, what's going to happen. And he instructs Moses that he is to lead the people of Israel to kind of double back. Apparently they were at one end of the Red Sea, and he is doubling them back so that they're opposite the middle of the Red Sea or something closer to it. And God instructs him to do this so that it will appear to Pharaoh that they're lost, that they're trapped, and that they're vulnerable. And he says, "Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart." We talked about this a little bit last time, but when it says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart, it is not, It doesn't seem to be the kind of thing where God reaches into his mind or his heart and hardens it in a way that you'd see him kind of indifferent towards the Israelites one moment, and the next moment, oh, I'm going to kill him. It's not that kind of dramatic change, but rather it's a change through forces that we would all recognize. The kinds of things that change our attitudes. That he was using human psychology as the tool by which he hardened Pharaoh's heart. And what he's doing here is he's making it look like the Israelites are lost and trapped and vulnerable. So it'd be easy for him to go and round them up again. Verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people. And they said, "What is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So he made his chariot ready and took his people with him. And he took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen, and his army, and they overtook them camping by the sea besides Pi-Hahiroth, in front of Baal Zephon. So Pharaoh and his officers have a bout of, is it buyer's remorse? They have second thoughts. The Israelites have gone, and he gave permission for them to go, but it was under duress. It was because there was so much suffering going on in Egypt, that the firstborn were dying in every household. Every household was being touched by this. So under that kind of pressure, Pharaoh said, okay, get out of here. But now a day or two has passed. The Israelites have fled all of the way to the Red Sea, and now he gets together with his officers, and they're saying, we shouldn't have let him go. That was a big mistake. Look at all that manpower wasted. We won't be able to build our temples. We won't be able to build our pyramids. So they decide to take off. And they go, it's 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt. So it's not a huge army, presumably, but it's a significant army, and it would have been state of the art. So they take off as fast as they can, and they catch up with the Israelites where the Israelites are camped, pinned against the Red Sea. Verse 10, and as Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." But Moses said to the people, "Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians, whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent." Now this is the picture that I wish I could paint. Here we have Moses, who has been appointed by God to lead these people. And Moses has been following the instructions of God. And God has told him a certain amount of what God is up to, what he's going to do. In this particular case, he had told Moses in the first part of chapter 14 that he was going to harden Pharaoh's heart, and that Pharaoh would chase after them. And then he said, "And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." That's what he has been told. So Moses has not been given all the details. All he knows is that he has been given instructions as to where they are to march, and God will take care of things. Now the people come to Moses, and they're saying, they look out and they see the army coming, the dust cloud. And here this Egyptian army is after them. They see him coming, and first they cry out to God. Then they turn to Moses, and they say, "Did you just bring us out here to die? I mean, we could have died more easily in Egypt. Why'd you bring us out here just to die? Why all of this pain and suffering for nothing, just so we can be slaughtered? It makes no sense." And they said, then they go through their "I told you so." They say, "Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." It was better back there. Yes, we were slaves. That's true. But it was better back there because we weren't dying. We didn't have an army coming after us to kill us. At least we could carry on our lives, even if we were slaves. But here, we're just going to get slaughtered. The thing that this points up is none of this exodus has been at the initiative of the Israelites themselves. They didn't ask for Moses to come along. They didn't ask for God to spring them from Egypt. In fact, there are several times when they castigated Moses for asking for permission to go. They would rather have not bothered. They would rather have stayed there. So it was at God's leading through Moses that all of this has come about. And if you think about it, there's probably a sense in which the plagues drew a wedge between the Israelites and the Egyptians. That is, some of them probably would have rather stayed, but after the plagues, there's probably a sense in which the Egyptians wanted to get rid of the Israelites. They had no choice but to go. He had created a tension or a friction there, or exacerbated it. So when they left, it was not because they wanted to go as much as they had no choice. So they've been spectators to this whole thing. And they continue to be spectators. This is not what they really want to be doing. But Moses' response is, "Don't fear. God is going to take care of it." And he tells them that the Egyptians that they see today, they will not see again forever. And in verse 14, "The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent." They will be spectators again. God's going to do it. They don't have to worry about it. It's very gracious of God. Verse 15. Oh, no, let me tell you about my painting, though. If you imagine the responses of the Israelites, I suspect there was a whole spectrum. Some who had seen what God had done in the plagues and had come to a point where they almost trust him. They almost think that he can pull off what he says that he's going to do. But they're puzzled because here come the Egyptians. There are others that they're just confused, just completely. What's going on here? I thought God was going to get us out of here. What's happening? Now we've got the Egyptians coming after us. I thought he had dealt with them. And you have others who are furious. God, Moses has led them into a trap. It is interesting that they cry out to God, and then they turn to Moses and complain. This is a pattern. They like to complain to Moses. And God's response is, "Moses is my man. If you're complaining to him, I'm not fooled. You're complaining to me." You're holding me responsible. You're blaming me. And I think he would say the same here, but it doesn't, it's not recorded. But they turned to Moses, and I would suspect that some of them were downright furious. They're saying, this is craziness. You've just brought us out here to be killed, slaughtered. This is ridiculous. And so you've got a whole spectrum of expressions on the faces of these Israelites as they see the Egyptian army coming after them. And Moses, he doesn't even know what's going to happen. He doesn't know how God is going to bring about this salvation. All he knows is that God said he would. So Moses is going, God's going to take care of it. I don't know how, but God's going to take care of it. He will fight for you. I can't tell you exactly how it's going to happen, but he will. Okay, verse 15. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. And as for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. And as for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen. And the angel of the Lord, who had been going before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel. And there was the cloud along with the darkness, yet it gave light at night. Thus the one did not come near the other all night. So now God tells Moses what he's going to do. Moses is to lift the staff. He's lifted the staff before. This is the same staff that he had when God spoke to him in the burning bush. And he's used that at a number of instances where God has told him to raise that staff. He will raise it another time, and this time the waters will divide. It's like, Moses, why are you crying out to me? Just lift your staff. I mean, it's like, come on, be smart. There's only one way out of here, and that is you got to walk through the Red Sea. So he's to raise his staff, the waters will divide, and they will go through on dry land. So that's the plan, the obvious solution. And the Egyptians are going to follow in afterwards, and they will be destroyed when the waters come crashing in on them. Okay, so that's what he tells Moses is going to happen, and that through that, that God is going to be honored. Then he has, you know, remember the cloud and the pillar that have been leading them? The cloud and the pillar now come behind the people of Israel. With the pillar of fire towards the Israelites and the cloud towards the Egyptians. And the result is the Israelites are illuminated all night long and are able to go about their business, get ready to go and start across on dry land. The Egyptians, on the other hand, are in darkness all night. This is interesting because it's language that's very reminiscent of Genesis chapter 1, in which God said, let there be light. And he made a division between the light and the darkness. And I suspect in Genesis 1, that is symbolic of the light that God, the illumination characteristic of truth and goodness, and the darkness that is characteristic of evil and rebellion. And here, as in the plagues, God has decided to make the distinction between his people and his enemies very stark. And so he's got the Israelites are illuminated, and we have the Egyptians in complete darkness throughout the night. They don't know what's going on. And it says, thus the one did not come near the other all night. There's no mixing of the two. God has made it literally black and white. Verse 21. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night, and turned the sea into dry land, so the waters were divided. And the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Then the Egyptians took up the pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen went in after them into the midst of the sea. And it came about at the morning watch that the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. And he caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians." This must have been a very eerie time. During the night, the waters had divided, and apparently the Israelites had, for the most part, gone through, or they're well on their way through. When morning breaks, the Egyptians see what's happening, and they start out. So it's dawn. It's just barely light. The wind has been blowing all night, so it must have been an eerie landscape or seascape. And the Egyptians see the Israelites in the water, between the walls of water, and they decide that we're going after them. God had hardened their hearts. They're going after them. And they start riding their chariots into this seabed, and the wheels start swerving, and they can't control the chariots. And they decide that something's not right here. God is apparently fighting for the Israelites. Let's get out of here. And it brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. Verse 26, then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak, while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen. Even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them, not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. So the waters crashed in at daybreak and wiped out the entire army that Pharaoh had assembled to chase after the Israelites. The Israelites, on the other hand, had made it clear through the sea on dry land and made it to the other side safely. This is an incredible story. The Israelites were trapped in a situation that had to have seemed absolutely hopeless. There was no way out. They were pinned against the water, and the most powerful army in the world was after them. They were essentially defenseless. If any of them were trained in warfare, it was not a large number. They were not armed. They had old men and women and children with them. They had no chariots. So they're pinned against the water, and here comes this army. It looks like they're done for. The only thing they've got going for them is God said that he would save them. And what does God do? He opens up this body of water. He just splits it. and they go through on dry land. And then God uses that same body of water then to destroy this army. And they see the evidence of that, dead bodies washed up on the shore. It's just like there had been a real battle. There are dead bodies laying there on the field. And yet they didn't have to lift a finger. Verse 31 is a strange verse. I find it strange. And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. I find it strange because two chapters later, they have forgotten. It takes a relatively short period of time for them to lose sight of what God had done for them. I mean, you'd think something like this, something as dramatic as this, would be so imprinted in their memories that they would never forget what God can do. They would never forget God's faithfulness. They'd never forget that God keeps his promises, does what he says that he's going to do. And yet, just a few weeks later, they do forget. In fact, over the next few chapters, they forget several times. And yet here it says, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. I think what it's saying here is there is a sense in which they really did trust God at this point in time. But it's a trust that is not developed. It's one that's easily shaken. God has more that he's going to do. There's more that he's going to put them through to make that faith solid, to make it firm, make it something that will withstand various trials and temptations. But at this point, it is a shaky faith that's been established. One of the things that... One of the things that is interesting to me in this passage is, and throughout all the section that we've been reading about the Pharaoh and God hardening the heart of Pharaoh, it would have been easy for the Israelites to see Pharaoh as the problem. Or even as maybe more specifically, for Moses to see Pharaoh as the problem. Pharaoh's been the one that's been holding them back. Pharaoh's the one that comes after them. And yet, Pharaoh and his attitude towards the Israelites is being engineered by God. Pharaoh really isn't the problem here. Pharaoh is just a pawn in the hands of God. Pharaoh's just this... God needed someone to put pressure on the Israelites, to, in a sense, to torment them, to be a bad guy with respect to the Israelites, from whom God would save him. So Pharaoh was not really the bad guy here. Pharaoh's not really the enemy here, in a sense. Pharaoh is a tool in God's hands to create faith in the hearts of the Israelites. And he serves that purpose well. Pharaoh will have to answer to God for what he did, as will every human being. But that is between Pharaoh and God. What's between the Israelites and God is how are they going to respond in this situation? Are they going to look to God for salvation? Or are they going to look at Pharaoh and see Pharaoh as the one, the source of the problem? Is the problem their faithlessness, or is the problem Pharaoh? And ultimately, the problem is their faithlessness and not Pharaoh. God can take care of Pharaoh. I find that an extremely important principle that I have to remind myself of on a daily basis in life. because it seems like there are many of my problems are caused by people. That there are at different times for different reasons, there are people that are the source of my problems. And if they would just straighten up their act, then my life would be wonderful. But as in this case, there's a sense in which they are just a tool in the hands of God. They're a tool in the hands of God to affect my life. And the question is, will I respond in a way that is responsible and faithful towards God? Will I respond with respect towards that other person? And in a way that is righteous, and let God take care of the problem, rather than wanting to slap that person around or whatever seems to be the solution. And I have to recognize that I am much like the people of Israel. That it's going to be a whole lifetime of lessons that I have to be put through before I learn to be truly faithful, to truly trust in Him to do what He's going to do, to bring about righteousness in my life, to change me the way I need to be changed. And that's true with respect to my relationships with other people as well as every other aspect of my life. And that's not true just of me, but I have to acknowledge that that's true of the other people that I'm dealing with, the people that seem to be the source of my problems. God is working with them as well. Some He's leading towards righteousness, and some will continue to be rebels forever. But nevertheless, He's working in their lives. Okay, questions or comments?
Okay, I think regarding miracles, generally they're explainable as natural phenomena that happen. It's not something that's completely out of the ordinary. Like the parting of the Red Sea, it really can't be that deep because the winds to part the waters like that, and the winds are incredibly strong, plus shallow water. Pharaoh's name being washed up on the shore, you know, what added to that. But I'm a bit confused on the pillar of light and clouds. I had splits. I don't know if you explained that. What do you think that was?
I have no idea. With respect to the Red Sea, there are two Israeli scientists who set up a model of the conditions, the topography in the Red Sea. And they calculated, and their model shows, that if the winds were to blow at 40 miles an hour from a certain direction for a period of, I think it was 8 hours straight, and if there was a ridge, if the Red Sea, here's the Red Sea, if there is a ridge running this way, a ridge on the floor of the sea, that it would create a wall of water here and a wall of water here. This one is a higher wall and this is a lower wall, but there would be two walls. Furthermore, if the winds were to decrease even a few miles per hour or drop off, that would close in within a matter of minutes. That would sweep back. So that's a possible explanation for how God could have done that. The only problem with that is that at least now there is no such ridge on the bottom of the Red Sea. They are hypothesizing that at that time there must have been. So that is a possible explanation on the basis of the laws of physics as we know them that could account for how this occurred. As far as the pillar of fire and the cloud, I have heard of no explanation that anyone has given to account for that. And I have no idea what it would be. But according to the Bible, that pillar of fire and that cloud are with them for 40 years. So it's a long, it's a phenomenon that was there for a long time. And it led them through the wilderness. I don't know. I don't know what kind of physical phenomenon could possibly account for that. I don't know. Bob?
Well, I'm not sure why we feel the urge or the need to try and come up with natural explanations. If this is really the creative God, he wants to, you know, work a miracle. Why can't he?
There are a couple of things there. This is a really tough one in my own mind. One is, I've mentioned before, in my mind, the line between the natural and the supernatural isn't there. What are the laws of physics but the way God usually does things? So in that sense, for me, it's not that big a deal. Was it supernatural or natural? I don't know. I don't know how to classify those. But God was the creator of the universe. And one thing that I think is a very important principle that comes out of Genesis chapter 1 is God dispelled chaos. God is the one who established order. And it is important for there to be order because it's on that basis that we understand. It is possible for us to reason because things are ordered, things are patterned. There are observations that we can make and generalizations we can make on the basis of those observations. So order is essential for the way that we think. And when God created things, he took a mass of chaos and established order and light. So it's possible for us to understand reality and understand him to the extent that he reveals himself to us. So I'm inclined to think that God is going to work according to the patterns he has established.
It seems likely that that pattern of order, which I think you're right, is very essential for us to even begin to think about reality and make sense out of it. We need to know that the sun's going to come up tomorrow morning and that the air is going to be breathable and stuff like that. And, you know, gravity's going to be the same direction as it was yesterday. But why couldn't that be a context within which God has the opportunity to work dramatically and, in a sense, contrary to the established pattern in certain instances for his purposes? I mean, for a demonstration of his power and his, the fact that he is not subject to these rules that he's established.
Yeah.
A miracle is, kind of loses some of its evidential power if it's just this rare natural occurrence.
Okay. Again, in my mind, I'm saying natural, supernatural, rare, yes. I mean, that's what God does, is he does things that are out of the ordinary to draw attention to the fact that he is in control of it. And not only out of the ordinary, but out of the ordinary at the right time. There are lots of things that happen every day that are out of the ordinary. But here it's out of the ordinary at a time that fits his purposes and is obviously linked to the history of what's going on. That's what's really significant to me. And that it is rare, that it is something that breaks the pattern in a sense, But there are two ways you can talk about breaking the pattern. One is breaking the laws of physics, and the other is a very unusual event that is consistent with the laws of physics. And can God, not can is not the question. Can God break the laws of physics? There's no question there. Does God break the laws of physics? I think the answer has to be yes, that there have been times when he's done that. But in general, I think, my suspicion is, in general, no, he doesn't. And that a lot of the miracles that he brings about, my guess is, are consistent with the laws of physics. But they are very unusual, complex application of those laws of physics.
Yeah, I guess it just seems like we spend a lot of energy and some people strain greatly to try and explain things by natural phenomena when I don't see the need to, and in fact, I kind of see a good reason not to, in the sense that, you know, what's a miracle? It's a demonstration of God's power, his ability to break his own laws if he wants to. And he usually has a very good purpose. You know, in this case, saving his people and giving him or giving them an evidence of his power. I mean, it seems like the more supernatural something is, in a sense, the greater evidence it is of God's power. And he uses those acts of power only in very certain circumstances where he wants to demonstrate something. So I guess I don't see the need, you know, to try and explain things by natural causes.
Men can turn water into wine, but they have to go through a long process and follow a formula. Christ turned it into wine, water into wine, instantly at thought, because he was God. And for what purpose? So that the guests at the wedding could get a little bit drunker, I guess. I don't know if there was a demonstration of any significance there, excepting that he demonstrated his power. And it was written.
Yeah, he...
There was a natural process that is available to men for that same purpose, right. But not certainly not at the speed of thought.
Not that virgin birth.
It spoke of the wheels on the chariots, the 600 times to begin to wobble and fall off. And then it becomes that those miracles were not miracles, but natural phenomena. Then the real miracle was how the Egyptian army drowned in 6 inches of water.
I clearly there are times when God has broken the laws of physics, but is he breaking the laws of physics in each of these? I don't know, and it's not really a big deal to me, because in my understanding of the world, I don't know where to draw the line between the supernatural and the natural. It's as if I drop something, God caused it to fall. It just so happens that he does that consistently. God has decided that that's the way he will do that. So if God, for instance, turns water into wine, is that a supernatural act or is that a natural act? Well, it doesn't make much difference to me. Those categories don't work. It's what God chose to do. Now, is it in conformity with the principles of physics as we know them? Well, probably not. But it could be that we don't know physics well enough. It could be that physics are a lot more complicated than we know. It could be that God's laws, by which the pattern that he has chosen to impose upon himself, the pattern, the way in which he will operate, that it accounts for that. It's still within his rules, but they're a very complex set of rules. Yes?
Well, it seems to me that part of what you're saying is that addresses the need for I've heard various people say that the further science discovers things, the less we need God. And from what you're saying, that doesn't work.
It doesn't make any difference.
No matter what.
Right.
And I think that's a really important distinction. Because you're right, we may not know how he did it, but we might know how he did it 50 years from now. Does that mean he didn't do it? Because now we can dissect it and determine how that happened. No. So I think that's important.
One of the things...
And it was not a rare occurrence. It was one time occurrence. It's not happened that we know of since. It happened at a time when the timing was needed. Rare just generally indicates that it's something that happens occasionally, but very seldom. And we have no other recorded history of or anyone else of any incident like this takes place. With other several incidents of the Bible.
Change the subject.
Sure.
I was thinking about what you said about the application into our own lives and how often we look at things outside of ourselves to blame our problems and the concept of, I guess I wanted to kind of expand on what you were saying, being faithful to God and trusting that He's doing something in the midst of conflict or hard things that I'd like to blame on things outside of myself. It seems to me that one of the ways of trusting God in that kind of circumstance is to be willing to look at my contribution to those things, my personal contribution, which is different than saying, God is doing something and I need to get out of the way. But I could actually be more responsible by taking on a really deep look at what I do to help that problem.
we are sinners. It is frequently the case that we are contributing to those problems. It is conceivable that there would be a case in which we aren't making any contribution at all. And still, the question is, am I going to see the other person or whatever as the source of the problem? Or do I need to see this as God working on me? And that, and to look to God for a resolution to that or to do what He's going to do through that.
Which might be nothing.
It may be something that will, a conflict, a tension that will exist the rest of your life.
It's good to see, to take this sort of, this story and see that it is kind of a bird's eye view, how it's explained that God did this in Pharaoh's heart. And that the Israelites were confused and upset and... It's encouraging in a way.
It is.
For our faith,
right.
Our belief. Because it seems like the older I get, the more I realize I just have no idea what's coming next.
Right.
Ever.
Right. If you put yourself in the shoes of the Israelites and what they knew and what they experienced and what they saw, it's a lot like our situations and what we know and what we see. But the Bible is giving us additional information about what He's doing through Pharaoh, and that Pharaoh, He's setting up Pharaoh. He's manipulating Pharaoh. And that's something that in our experience we're not privy to. We have to take that on faith, that God's working in other people as well. And that He's using them for His purposes, which are very complex. But part of those purposes involve making us righteous people. Faithful and righteous people. And that's a difficult thing to keep in perspective.
Regarding Kurt's sort of question, the pillar of fire and the pillar of the cloud, could you elaborate on verse 19? Is it possible to assume?
And what are you thinking?
Well, it seems to suggest as an angel of God who's been going before the camp, even with finding, suggesting that there's a possible explanation about the door of fire. It doesn't say anything about the cloud.
You mean that it equates this pillar with the angel?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Larry?
In listening to you read it and reading it, it sounds like simultaneously there's a wall of water that's where people are walking, Israelites are walking through, and there's also the water's breaking down and people from Egypt are drowning at the same time. Do you read it the same way?
Well, I mean, one could understand it that way. It seems to me one could also understand it as not so much being strictly chronological as just kind of describing the scene. Can you tell what I mean? It's not giving us a minute-by-minute account of who's where, but rather that it's giving us the understanding that the Israelites pass through on dry ground and the Egyptians move in and it closes in on them. I think that that's more likely what's going on. Okay, thanks.